Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown Podcast. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the Managing Editor for Debtwire Municipals. Joining me today are two recurring guests to the program, the Head of Research for DW Munis, Greg Clark, and one of our fine reporters, Simone Baribault. Welcome to the podcast, Simone and Greg.
It's great to be here.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, the podcast title for today's episode is New York City's Congestion Questions and Florida's Premium Pitfalls. Today, we'll be discussing the renewed effort to implement congestion pricing in New York City and Florida's readiness for the upcoming hurricane season, which starts on June 1st from an insurance perspective. And I'll add for both you guys, this has personal interest in that, Greg, you commute down from Summers, New York into the city. And Simone, you're in the eye of the storm, living in Miami, dealing with hurricane threats every year. But first, Greg, let's talk about New York City. Greg, are you familiar with the phrase, don't call it a comeback, it's been here for years?
I have not heard that, but I like it.
Okay, well, it's a rap phrase, but I thought it was appropriate for this subject matter because congestion pricing has been around, hanging around for a couple of years. We actually did a podcast on this a couple of years ago. So congestion pricing has been a goal of New York's Metropolitan Transportation Authority for a number of years now. And recently there was some news regarding this project. Tell us what's the latest, Greg.
Well, Paul, earlier this month, the Federal Highway Administration gave tentative approval to a report that deals with the plan's potential harm on disadvantaged communities. This tentative approval started a 30-day public review period, so there should be some more headlines regarding all of this in early June. The MTA now says that the tolling program could begin as soon as spring of 2024. So a little background on history. The congestion pricing program was authorized and is required by a state law passed in 2019. It's modeled on programs in London and some other major cities outside the U.S., and has two purposes, the first of which is to reduce traffic congestion in Manhattan's Central Business District, and the second is to raise revenues for MTA's capital projects. Actually, you might be able to reverse those in terms of importance. Might be that the most important is to raise revenues for MTA, second, to reduce traffic congestion. I guess the order of prominence will depend on who you talk to. But for purposes of this project, the Central Business District is defined as the area south of 60th Street in Manhattan. To add some geographical context, 59th Street is the southern border of Central Park.
Okay. One question that comes up to me is why is federal approval even necessary for this project? If it only affects Manhattan, it would seem that city and state approvals should be all that's necessary.
I've wondered the same thing myself, and the answer is that Manhattan's streets and roads have benefited from past federal funding, so that's one pretext for the federal involvement. There have also been environmental reviews, which to me is a bit of a head-scratcher, if only for the fact that under the program, there is going to be at least some traffic reduction, and that seems to be a favorable environmental outcome, regardless of your politics. One other comment, the actual name of the congestion pricing plan, as it's popularly referred to, is the Central Business District Tolling Program. And one reason for this name, probably the primary reason, is that the MTA already collects what are called congestion zone surcharges. These are levied on taxis, ride-sharing companies such as Uber, and on carpools when their trips begin south of 96th Street in Manhattan. So those of our listeners who want to do some of their own research on all of this should be aware of these sometimes confusing terms.
Well, I learned something new today. I didn't know there was already congestion zone surcharges. But let's get back to the Central Business District Tolling Program. I'll call it CBD plan from here on in. How will it raise money for the MTA, and how exactly will revenues from the plan be used?
Well, revenues for the CBD plan will be used for the MTA's five-year capital plan, which assumes the sale of $15 billion in bonds that will be paid by CBD toll revenues.
So, Greg, you know I call you the E.F. Hutton of the Muni market. So this question I'm really interested in, what's your opinion of the plan?
Well, here's one big problem I see. The state legislation authorizing the plan requires tolls to be set so that they generate $1 billion annually. If the MTA wants to sell bonds that'll be secured only by CBD tolls, the $1 billion annual requirement makes suspect any traffic projections that accompany a bond offering. And this is in turn because the traditional way of doing these projections, and I'm simplifying here, is X times Y equals Z, where X is the number of vehicles tolled, Y is the average toll per vehicle, and Z is the amount when you get the amount you get when you multiply X times Y. To put it another way, Z, the product, is the amount of revenues that support the bonds that in turn will finance the project. But when you start with Z, in this case $1 billion, you're starting with the result, not with an objective assessment of what traffic counts and tolls will be. A better law, in my opinion, would have been something like, you know, the MTA will make every effort to maximize revenues from the plan. I think that would have been a more realistic approach, but that's not what the state did.
Greg, I have a question. You mentioned before that they're expecting at least some drop off in traffic, which would be what made it less congested. How are the people who are no longer driving in, how are they getting into the city? And will that generate any revenue for the MTA?
That's a good question, Simone. I haven't seen any projections related to that. I guess it depends to some extent on what percent of would-be drivers who will be dissuaded from driving now are from New Jersey, which are from New York, and how many will stop coming into the city. I think the MTA assumes that there will be some pickup in mass transit ridership and therefore revenues. But again, I haven't seen anything concrete on that.
Already fewer people are going into offices because of the post-pandemic new reality. How does that affect the MTA's projections?
Well, we haven't seen projections yet. We've seen historic traffic counts in some ways, but we haven't seen any projections yet. And I think that's the million-dollar question. Until we see those, we won't be able to judge the validity of the assumptions behind the plan.
All right, Greg. So what's another way that they could bond out the CBD revenues?
Well, it's possible that the MTA could put CBD revenues into the pool of monies for its transportation revenue or tri-borough bridge bonds, which are two of their major borrowing programs, and use the incremental CBD revenue, whether it's $1 billion or whatever it is, to pay debt service on greater amounts of those types of bonds. And this might be the plan. The MTA has already sold $193 million of, quote, second subordinate revenue bond anticipation notes, end quote. I'll call them bands, proceeds of which are being used to pay preliminary costs of the CBD program. Sources of payments for the bands, which are due November 2025, include rollover notes and long-term bonds. The legal documents for the bands permit, but do not obligate MTA to pay debt service on those obligations from CBD revenues. This tells me that the MTA is kind of keeping its powder dry in terms of how they're a source of revenues to pay any bonds that are secured by in whole or in part by CBD revenues.
So, Greg, I remember we published some research about a year and a half ago entitled "The MTA's World Has Changed, But Its Congestion Pricing Goals Haven't." And remind me again of what we're getting at with the research. And one thing I remember from your research was you had a question about the number of exemptions that were going to be granted to certain groups. So if you could touch on that, please do.
Sure. And this also keys into Simone's earlier question. The point of that research article, again, this was about 18 months ago, was that the MTA is now operating in a very much different environment than it was when the CBD plan received state approval 4 years ago. The biggest and most obvious difference is that compared to early 2019, there are more people working from home and an additional commuting fee. In this case, the CBD tolls could persuade even more people to avoid a Manhattan commute. If that happens, this clearly wouldn't be good for the city's economic base in general and would have some effect on property taxes and on sales taxes. There have been some calls for exemptions. The people who live in Manhattan, I think in the zone, again, below 60th Street, who have incomes below a certain level would receive a credit on their state income taxes. I guess there are pros and cons with that. And I mean, if I'm somebody and I'm paying the toll, then waiting a year for reimbursement is not ideal. But anyway, New Jersey politicians are not happy at all with this plan. And I think there might be some litigation regarding that. I think it's fair to say that this plan, you know, you got federal approval to a degree. I think there might be some more hitches along the way.
Thanks, Greg. So let's switch gears a little bit. Let's take things down to Miami. Hurricane season is coming up. It starts on June 1st. That's significant in Florida's municipal market because of Citizens Property Insurance, the state-run insurer, which is a large issuer of debt. Since Citizens has become a hot-button issue recently, as the number of policies has grown on what's supposed to be an insurer of last resort, the legislature has enacted new laws to try to cut back the number of policies. You also have the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund, which reimburses private sector insurers for a portion of their losses. And of course, you could argue that hurricanes affect pretty much every credit because insurance costs increases are becoming a fact of life and any property is at risk of getting hit. And one other thing, listeners, I'd like you to be aware of. My friend Simone and colleague, she lives there in Miami. And during the winter in December, January, February, March, she's so kind to send me pictures of the sun, the sand, how things are doing so well. And I always have to remind her, well, but you do have to deal with hurricane season. Obviously, we don't want anything bad to happen, but it's just a fact of life that we are approaching hurricane season. Now, with that said, Simone.
A gleeful fact of life.
Yes. So with hurricane season just a few days away, how is Florida prepared?
It's trying to get prepared, but the problem is it's hard. Citizens' policies, as you mentioned, are ballooning because private insurers don't want the risk in the state. We've been hit by a lot of hurricanes recently. We had in 2022 alone, Ian and Nicole. And Ian probably cost about $10 billion to the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund, which has said that if another major storm comes up, they're likely to have to issue debt. And the way they issue debt is to back it by emergency assessments on Floridians' other insurance policies, auto insurance, or all manner of insurance. So that would make things more expensive for Floridians. And the problem with Florida is that other than that, we're surrounded by water. A lot of the state is very low-lying. So here in Miami, where you mentioned I live, we measure our homes by the number of feet above sea level. So my house is 11 feet above sea level, and that's actually quite high. And we're not considered to be in a flood zone. But even at our towering 11 feet, some homes on our street, this is according to my neighbor, I haven't actually fact checked this, but some homes on our street have trouble because of a drain that backs up in the rain. So that causes flooding in those homes.
So Simone, let me ask one other background question. Since you have been living down there, is it your experience that the storms over this, let's say the last decade, have they been more frequent and intense? Have they been the same? What's your perspective on that?
Well, I've only lived here a little over a decade, so I can't personally compare it to before then. Of course, the worst storm in Miami was Hurricane Andrew, which was in the 90s. But we get weirder phenomenon now than we used to. The flooding in Fort Lauderdale last month, it's not hurricane season. It wasn't a hurricane. It was just a lot of rain. People think of hurricanes as being primarily about, you know, this huge rainfall in an area. It's not so much the rainfall, it's the windstorm. So flood insurance and windstorm insurance are two completely different things. Flood insurance is federal. Actually, that's a good question. If you looked at Miami, you probably wouldn't see any increase in the number of hurricanes because we had a really, in the past 10 years, because we had a bad 2006, 2007 year. But across the state, I don't know the answer, but there are definitely more unusual phenomenon going on now.
So with that backdrop, how is the state preparing?
The legislature, as you said, is trying to get people off of Citizens. So they made a number of changes to lower the rolls. In December, they made it easier to push people off of Citizens into the private market. So now if you can get insurance from the private market, that's no more than 20% more expensive than what it costs to get Citizens, and you're no longer eligible for the state insurance under the new law. And whether you have Citizens or a private market insurer, they've also made it so that it's more difficult to get claims paid. You have less time to file a claim. You have 1 year now. Until recently, it was 3 years, but the last change changed it from 2 years to 1 year. You can't transfer contracts to third parties. So it was a pretty common practice. Your house got hit by a hurricane. You'd hire a company to do the repair work. You wouldn't pay them anything, but you'd sign over your rights to insurance claims. And then the company would go after the insurer. So they would presumably have more resources than any resident. So that's no longer allowed. All residents will have to pay their own attorney's fees. So if you can't afford an attorney, you won't be able to dispute it if an insurer refuses to pay.
Why would the state want people off of Citizens?
The idea is that Citizens is a risk to all Florida residents. Right now, there are almost 1.3 million policies in force, so they cover 1.3 million properties. And that's a lot for what's supposed to be the insurer of last resort. Hasn't always been that way. In January 2020, there were just over 440,000 policies in force. And the goal is to get the number of policies back down to around that level. If Citizens runs out of money, as I mentioned before, pretty much every insurance policy in the state, auto insurance, any type of insurance, gets an emergency assessment. So you pay whatever the assessment is, 1%, 2%, 5% more until any bonds sold to pay for that claim are paid back. And that's an assessment that has periodically been implemented after storms. So if there's a bad storm in Jacksonville, people in Miami ultimately will end up paying for part of it. But that can happen with private sector insurance too. United Property and Casualty Insurance became insolvent after Hurricane Ian. So the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation approved a 1% emergency assessment on insurance policies, and it's looking to sell up to $900 million through the Florida Insurance Assistance Interlocal Agency to pay those claims. So the challenge isn't really getting people off as Citizens. The challenge is getting people onto private insurers that won't go under.
So with that in mind, is the state also looking for reinsurance coverage to bolster Citizens?
Yes, exactly. There was a telling gubernatorial press release last month. Governor DeSantis went to London and met with reinsurance companies. The governor said that, and I'm quoting here, access to affordable reinsurance options for Florida carriers is important for the stabilization and long-term growth of our property insurance market. So you're having Florida look abroad for help keeping its insurance market working. There was a recent report out saying that reinsurance coverage for private insurers is getting a lot more expensive, but it's mostly available this year. So that's good.
So is the state doing anything proactively to mitigate hurricane and flooding risk?
It's an interesting question. It's trying to do a few things, but it's hard to say what's working. Florida's building codes are making new homes more resistant to flooding, but because they're often built on fill, that might be increasing flooding for neighbors with older homes since the water doesn't have many places to go. The building codes say new construction can't put old construction at risk, but it still might be doing just that. The state budget this year includes $500 million of federal funds to plan for sea level rise. And that's important even when you're not in hurricane season, as the flooding in Fort Lauderdale that I mentioned before reminded us. In terms of bigger measures, the elephant in the room, if you'll forgive the pun, is the Republican primaries. Today is Wednesday when we're recording this, and Governor DeSantis is likely to declare that he'll run for president in 2024 today. And he's been leading the state toward more conservative stances on issues, including the environment. But it's Florida. People here still really care about the environment, and you get a real dissonance with statements. And that's nothing new. Florida's last governor, Rick Scott, for a long time said he didn't know if climate change was man-made. Nothing had convinced him it was. So you have a government that's willing to take some steps to mitigate damage from sea level rise, but not really willing to do anything proactively to deal with global warming. And you have a couple of competing news releases that highlight that difference. There was one recent news release where Governor DeSantis says, and I'm quoting again, "Since day one, the resiliency of our state has been a top priority for my administration. This legislation," and he's referring here to money for environmental projects, "will allow us to build on historic investments and progress by ensuring communities have the resources they need for resilience planning." But at the same time, Governor DeSantis has been a vocal supporter of barring Florida's pension funds and also local government pensions and other funds from considering environmental guidance factors when investing. And when he and his allies talk about these measures, his manner of discussing them is ideological. In the press release barring local governments from taking environmental, social, and corporate governance measures into consideration, the governor's office said that Florida had a government of laws, not woke politics. So this rhetoric arguably makes addressing climate change at the state level more difficult. And you have environmental bills that pass the session, and they still haven't been signed by the governor, which appear environmentally dangerous on their faces. One would allow radioactive waste material to be used in road construction, and another would temporarily block any new seasonal fertilizer bans. And there's another one that makes it more difficult for local governments to pass any type of ordinance, including environmental ordinances. The state's in a difficult position because we feel the effects of changes in weather acutely, but we've also taken a stance in the culture wars that makes it unlikely for us to take any big steps in the short term.
Well, let's hope that this is a relatively mild hurricane season for the state of Florida as the state tries to figure out all of these issues.
Yes, I hope so.
So thank you, Greg and Simone, for your contributions to this week's podcast. To our audience, I hope you found this episode informative. Thank you for listening to the Muni Lowdown. Please support us by liking, sharing, and or subscribing to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere that you listen to podcasts. Join us every Thursday for the latest drop of the Muni Lowdown. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the host and guests. They do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of ION Analytics or any affiliated entities. The information shared in this podcast is for general informational purposes and should not be considered as professional advice.